rise. Oi, all persons having business before the honor of the United States Court of Appeals will make their claim, drawn back and give your attention, for this honorable court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Scholem. Before we begin today, we have a preliminary matter. At this time, we'll take motions for the admission to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Mr. Sklar.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Carrie Sklar, counsel to the clerk of the court. And this morning, I am pleased to move the admission of Barbara Burns Harris of Washington, D.C. to the bar of this honorable court. And I am satisfied that Ms. Harris possesses all the necessary qualifications and meets all the requirements of the court. Thank you.
It is hereby ordered that the motion for admission to the bar of this court is hereby granted. Ms. Harris, please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to conduct yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I do.
Thank you very much. The court congratulates you. We look forward to your contribution to our fine bar.
Thank you.
Well, my little cheat sheet here says we will not proceed to the matter of Untilin, but I think it's supposed to say we will proceed to the matter of Untilin versus Nicholson, docket number 031628. Will counsel for both parties please introduce themselves?
Kenneth Carpenter, Your Honor, on behalf of Mr. Untilin.
Thank you.
Tracy Elton, on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you.
Carol Washington, on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
Yes. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Untilin. The court, please, I believe that in order to correctly dispose of this case, an interpretation of 38 U.S.C. 6104A is required to be made. In preparation for the argument in this case, I reviewed both the CSAs and the USCA, and the cases cited therein, and discovered two D.C. Circuit cases which I submitted as supplemental authority to this court. Following the review of both of those cases, I reviewed the record in this matter and discovered that there is a question as to whether or not the provisions of 6104A were lawfully applied by the Secretary in the first instance. 6104A is a forfeiture proceeding.
Is this anywhere in your brief, Mr. Carpenter?
No, Your Honor, it is not. But it
and
goes
I think that...
I'm sorry?
Well, I think the law of the court is if it's not raised in the opening brief, it's not capable of being argued.
But the question before this court, Your Honor, is the question of new and material evidence. The Federal Circuit in both Barrett and Jackson have held that the question of reopening based upon new and material evidence is a question for the Board of Jurisdiction to determine whether or not the Secretary does or does not have jurisdiction. The question of the interpretation of 6104A, therefore, goes to the Board.
But that still wasn't argued.
No, Your Honor, it was not. What was argued was whether or not the decision was properly made based upon a question of duress. We have extraordinary circumstances in this case, Your Honor, and if necessary, I will file a petition for extraordinary relief in order to join this question. We have an 85-year-old veteran who in 1971 made an application for benefits. Instead of adjudicating that application for benefits, the VA initiated a forfeiture proceeding. Mr. Untalan, since 1990, has...
Let me jump on Judge Hagel's questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understood it, the forfeiture decision was not appealed. It became final.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And your client attempted to reopen.
Well, my client was required to reopen based upon the VA's imposition of the duty under 5108 to submit new and material evidence.
Correct. And there the is board determined that it was not new.
That's correct. But the board is also required under Barrett and Jackson to determine whether or not the secretary properly exercised its jurisdiction in considering the matter. The cases that I have submitted as supplemental authority from the D.C. Circuit suggest that a forfeiture proceeding is not a claim. And if a forfeiture proceeding is not a claim, then the imposition of the 5108 burden upon Mr. Untalan was unlawful. 7261 imposes upon this court the scope of review to determine whether or not the decisions of the secretary were unlawful. Specifically, in 7261A3, it says that this court
shall... Why would you bring that under this particular proceeding? Why wouldn't you bring a different action? Why wouldn't you seek Q or something along those lines?
Well, yeah, because I'm not sure that it is a Q. I would suggest that, in fact, what we have here is a pending and unadjudicated claim from 1971, and that the action initiated by the secretary under 6104 was simply unlawful. And this court has an obligation under 7261A3 to hold unlawful and set aside any finding or decision of the secretary. It also includes the Board of Veterans Appeals in that mandate that the court finds to be unlawful because it was not made in accordance with law.
Sorry, counsel. You're going to have to back up and explain to me, where exactly is the unlawful action?
The forfeiture proceeding in 1975 that was the subject matter of the decision that Mr. Untalan, since 1990, has been required by the secretary to submit new and material evidence to reopen.
So it was the decision, not the action of requiring new material evidence, that is unlawful, or both?
Actually, both, Your Honor. The proceeding that was before the board was new and material evidence, and this case has been to this court on four different occasions on the question of new and material evidence. I am suggesting to the court that this court has an obligation to review the entire record to determine whether or not the proceedings initiated were lawful in the first instance, and to require the board, as part of its obligation to determine whether the secretary was correctly exercising jurisdiction, or I should say correctly declining to exercise jurisdiction.
Is there something unique about Mr. Antolin's case that makes the processing, in your opinion, unlawful? Or, for example, how does this mesh with the court's decision in Trillis, which found that new material evidence should be submitted in a forfeiture determination of a Filipino veteran's claim?
In the Trillis case, Your Honor, the court did not get to the question of the propriety, but simply remanded on a reasons and bases and decided that the board decision as presented was not capable of review because of a lack of reasons and bases.
But the court clearly implied that a new material evidence standard would be appropriate as opposed to the preponderance of the evidence standard that was being discussed in a different line of cases.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's why it seems to me that this case needs to be addressed by the court under the interpretation of 6104A, which was not arrived at in any of the prior cases. And the
I'd just like to clarify for a minute. As I read that case, and I'm quoting now, it's in Section C. I don't have the exact page number. 325, it looks like. We now hold that a VA benefits recipient or claimant who has been the subject of a final decision declaring forfeiture of eligibility for VA benefits may have that final decision reopened upon the presentment of new material evidence or revised based on the finding of Q.
Right, but
and that you're here arguing, and this was an en banc case, if I'm not mistaken, and you're arguing today that they didn't hold new material. You're suggesting that it's not subject to Q.
I'm sorry.
And you're raising a new argument, which I guess you can raise at any time, that there's no jurisdiction at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I was on the wrong case. I was on Veller.
Actually, your argument was that there's no jurisdiction of the board, wasn't there?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that this court, under its broad authority under 7261, to include 7261A2, shall compel an action of the secretary that was unlawfully withheld and unreasonably delayed, which would be, in this case, the adjudication of the 1971 pending claim.
Which, again, has not been argued by the appellant until right now.
That's correct, Your Honor, because it all ultimately goes to the question of jurisdiction and the exercise of jurisdiction. As I understand the Federal Circuit's decisions in both Barrett and Jackson, the Federal Circuit has explained that the analysis required under 5108 by the Board of Veterans Appeals is to determine whether or not the Secretary is or is not obligated to exercise jurisdiction to reconsider the matter based upon the submission of new and material evidence. 5108, which is the statutory basis for reopening, specifically involves a previous disallowance of a claim. A forfeiture proceeding is not a claim under the Wellman and Gleason decisions of the D.C. Circuit because they do not go to the award of a benefit. But more importantly in this case, the underlying question is under 6104A, is there a basis for the secretary to forfeit benefits which have not been authorized? I would direct the court's attention to 5308 and 5309 of 38 U.S.C., in which Congress clearly is advised that there is a difference between the withholding of benefits which have been awarded, and in that case it is for persons who are found within the territory of the enemy, and 5309 provides for the payment of any withheld benefits during such a period of time. I would submit that 5303 is the appropriate statutory proceeding to bar benefits when the VA makes a determination that there is a statutory basis barring the right to benefits. 6104A, however, is a different proceeding. And in every case other than Vela Rus, which is at 7 Vet App 561, none of the other cases that have been before this court have been similar to the case involving Mr. Untalan, in which there did not appear to have been a previous grant of benefits. In the Gleason case and the Wellman case, clearly both of those cases involved a previous award and then a subsequent attempt to forfeit under the appropriate statutory authority, the predecessor statute to 6104A. In the Vela Rus case, however, it appears that Mr. Vela Rus was in the same circumstance in that he had made an application for benefits and a forfeiture proceeding was initiated. And I apologize to Judge Scholin. I got my two different cases confused.
So go over the facts again for me. In this instance,
there
were no benefits ever sought.
No, there was an application made in 1971. It's in the record at 38, pages 38 to 41. No action was taken by the secretary on that application, at least that is in the record. I have to confess that I am limited to what's in the record, as I believe this court is. And then the next proceeding is a forfeiture decision, which was made in 1976, which is at pages 93 to 98, and that gives a summary of the evidence and begins with a September 23, 1971 receipt of a VA Form 21526 in which Mr. Untalan had made an application for benefits. There is no indication in that summary of evidence or adjudicatory actions that any favorable disposition was taken on that application in order to award benefits.
What statute, again, do you believe it should have been processed under? 5303?
No, Your Honor. I was pointing the court's attention to 5303 as the statutory authority to bar benefits without making an adjudication on the claim. However, a review of 5303 does not contain the rendering assistance to the enemy language as a basis for barring benefits.
If benefits have been granted under your theory,
yes, Your Honor.
Could the VA have properly then forfeited those benefits?
Well, I don't believe they would have had a lawful basis, but they certainly
could have initiated that proceeding. And the procedure
correct.
That they would have used, would it not have been the one that they followed?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So if they used the appropriate procedure if benefits were, in fact, granted, and absent and if, in fact, those procedures were properly followed, where is the individual prejudiced by using the wrong statute to proceed when he apparently got full process?
Well, because, frankly, Your Honor, he would have first been entitled to the benefits, and the subsection in 6104B provides for an apportionment to his dependents. And if he had dependents, and frankly, I do not know whether he had dependents.
But that apportionment is in effect even if they're barred, right? Even if they're forfeited.
Yes, even if they're forfeited.
Okay. So again, if the procedure was, how is this individual prejudiced if all of that procedure was followed?
That dovetails with Mr. Wood's argument in his brief about the right to present the defense of duress. It also goes to the question of the prejudice of the VA's failure to follow the two D.C. Circuit cases, which we submitted as supplemental authority.
Well, I don't see how it deals with the inability to present the offense of duress. That issue is dealt with under the new material evidence rubric, it seems to me. That's the complaint, and that's the issue that's raised in the brief.
But the question in the brief, the reason it would be new and material evidence is that it would go to his right to have presented that defense. And what I'm suggesting is, Your Honor, that in 1971, the controller, or excuse me, 1976 or 5, when the forfeiture decision was actually made, the controlling law was with the D.C. Circuit. In the 1958 decision in Wellman and the 1962 decision in Gleason, both of which dealt with the question of rendering assistance to the enemy and specifically required that there be additional evidence beyond simply a mere statement that he participated in the constabulary. And that is the only evidence that was available. And what I'm suggesting is that they could not have...
Is it the position of Mr. Untalan, apart from your jurisdictional argument, that he was barred from presenting his claim of duress or necessity?
I'm suggesting that the decision made in 1975 or 76, the forfeiture decision, was inconsistent with the law. The law as articulated by the D.C. Circuit as to what the evidentiary requirements were.
Because the D.C. Circuit said that you had to have some sort of an overt act.
Overt act, right. That's correct.
Okay. Now, that's not the standard. What's the standard here for barring benefits, for forfeiting benefits?
I believe that is the standard.
The standard is within the discretion of the Secretary. Isn't that the statutory standard?
Yes, but the Secretary's discretion is controlled by the interpretation of the statutory requirements. Mm-hmm. The Secretary cannot have unbridled discretion to exercise discretion contrary to two D.C. Circuit cases that say that the Secretary cannot exercise that discretion.
But your theory would depend upon some sort of factual finding that, in fact, that forfeiture occurred based solely upon some sort of statement that Mr. Untalan made.
Well, as I read the board's decision in this case, they said that the basis was another individual who said that Mr. Untalan participated in the constabulary.
But that deals with participation. The two cases you cited from the D.C. Circuit said that actually remanded to the board or to the secretary for consideration under the standard. Because it was apparent that the secretary had made a decision based upon the mere statements of the individual about their view of the war, the Korean War, and the United States' participation in the Korean War and their membership in the Communist Party. The statements that are recited by the board in this case are statements of the individual, but they deal with actions that the individual took. So, but anyway, those are factual determinations that, and it seems to me, are left to the board, not a legal determination.
But the board dealt with that not on the merits, Your Honor. The board only dealt with that within the limited rubric, if you will, of the 5108 lens as to whether or not the testimony provided by Mr. Untalan of duress constituted a valid defense, which therefore would have been new and material evidence, which would have been required to reopen under 5108. But if under both the Wellman and Gleason cases, as I believe they hold, that a forfeiture proceeding is not a claim proceeding, because the forfeiture proceeding is a proceeding initiated by the secretary not intended to award benefits, but intended to deprive a veteran of benefits.
Let me jump in.
Sorry, Your Honor.
I'm seeing three issues. One, to your, what appears to be your argument today, is that the entire proceedings below are void. There's no jurisdiction. There's
That's
some
correct.
Claim still outstanding.
That's correct.
Wrong
right.
process used. Second, you seem to be arguing that to the extent the original decision may have some validity jurisdictionally, that it was the wrong law was applied. And on that second one, it would seem that you would have to attack that, assuming there was a jurisdiction, through Q, as we have previously held in an en banc case. And third, the one that has been briefed in the written briefs, is that there was a final decision. There was an attempt to reopen it with new material evidence, a board decision that determined it was new, and an argument that mens rea had not been presented in the past, and therefore your client had presented new material. Does that sum up?
I would only modify the second, Your Honor. I believe the second argument is that a forfeiture proceeding is not a claim, and therefore it is not subject to the 5108 requirements for reopening.
So assuming there was some kind of jurisdiction, we have a final decision. This is the second that I talked about.
Yes.
And the what would be the means then of your submitting new information? If it's not a claim, new material does not apply to it. How would you address that?
Well, yeah, I think...
Would it not be through Q? Because Q doesn't apply to it either because it's not a claim?
That's right. I believe that the correct remedy is to direct the secretary to merely reconsider without the 5108 burden. In other words...
What authority do you have for him to just reconsider or for us to tell him to reconsider? Maybe there is no means for you to reopen it.
The two D.C. Circuit cases held in similar circumstances that the veteran was able to present this type of evidence in a forfeiture proceeding. And they said that they had authority to review, even though there wasn't judicial review available.
All right, your time is up.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Before you begin, I'm going to go over the three that we've kind of discussed. It seems to me there's an argument here that the entire process below is void, no jurisdiction, to the extent you can address that and want to. Second, it appears as though, to the extent there is jurisdiction, it was wrongly decided. Neither Q nor new material applied to that, and some process should be brought about where the court directs the secretary to reconsider, and what authority there might be for that. And then there is the issue that was briefed, which is that there was a final decision, new material, the board determined it was not new.
Yes, Your
Honor. So tell me which one you want to discuss, at what point.
Well, I guess we'll go with in order with the first one. The two cases that appellant's counsel has cited, Thompson and Wellman, I want to advise the court, they have been superseded by statute in 1970. Congress amended 38 U.S.C. Section 211A specifically overruling cases Wellman and Thompson. In a subsequent case, Carter v. Cleland, it's a D.C. Circuit case in 1980, specifically noted that these two cases were overturned. Now, I think that's important here because what the D.C. Circuit was attempting to do in Wellman and Thompson was to find a way to review veterans' claims for benefits. And previously, during that period of time, there was not the Court of Veterans' Appeals. There was not judicial review of these cases. And so in order to do that, D.C. Circuit was trying to carve out an explanation about what a claim is. And they were saying, you know, in essence, that they could review it because this was agency action and it was not like an initial claim for benefit. They were trying to carve out some kind of exception. That was specifically overturned or superseded by a subsequent statute. Now, I think a good argument to be made is that all their basis of what a claim is or isn't was superseded by that statute at all. In addition, it was struck down. So with regard to appellant's counsel's majority of his argument that this is not a claim, the Secretary's position is that, you know, that the case law that he has cited doesn't apply. Also that, you know, the D.C. Circuit cases are not binding on this court. It's a separate circuit. So this court need not follow them, and I believe this court has already answered in this context of what a claim is in Trillis, as far as this is a new and material evidence case, and can follow that. Now, I'm a little bit confused about his second argument in addressing that. He did mention at one time that that the Secretary has a burden to discuss or grant benefits before they can forfeit them, I believe was an argument he was making. I don't know if that goes to his second one or not, but I would like to address that. Specifically, appellant's counsel cites no authority that requires the VA to do this, and as he noted, there has already been a case that this court has addressed and made a decision on that had similar facts, in that the forfeiture happened before a grant of benefits was given. And
but if he's correct, would we not be proper in readdressing that, perhaps at an en banc level if necessary?
I'd assume, yes, Your Honor, I mean, if he's correct, but I don't think there's anything from the statute that requires an underlying adjudication of the claim, and I think there's just a common sense.
Well, intuitively, how do you forfeit before you get?
Well, what sense would it make to say in the event that you would maybe be entitled to benefits, but we know you're barred? It doesn't make any sense to go through the steps of granting a claim when you already have this evidence that you know this person's not going to be given. It would be the same thing as like a willful misconduct. If you have the evidence there that he's not entitled, then why force the VA to go through those extra steps of determining what he would have gotten and placing a rating and all those, assigning a rating and all those extra
steps? Well, how about his argument that if he had family, that they might have been eligible for an apportionment?
He can still make that argument now.
But there's no benefit to apportion because he wasn't granted anything.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And at that point, they would determine. They would determine if they were willing to, what they would be willing to give him and what they'd be willing
so
to
right
give
now,
him.
If he had a dependent, let's say, that was eligible, a spouse or whatever, he could just file a claim to adjudicate his earlier claim so that they could apportion? Or would he still be required to file under new material evidence, submit new material evidence and reopen his original claim, we'll call it?
Well, I have to go back and check, but I'm not sure that in the 1976 there was an additional provision for them to, under forfeiture of treason, for the dependents to receive.
Let's just say for the sake of argument there was.
Okay.
Or better yet, say today. Somebody came in and filed for benefits, had a family, noted it all, would you go through the forfeiture proceedings? Do you know?
I believe that if there was an attempt to claim benefits for the dependents, that the VA would consider that, yes.
And he wouldn't be required to meet the reopening threshold.
Well, if it was brought at the initial decision.
Well, let's just say it were brought today when...
Right. I mean, that, I believe that's what Your Honor's question was, if it was brought today.
No, I think Judge Sholin's question is, let's assume...
That it was denied.
That it was denied.
Okay.
Well, or
later
that it
came
was
in,
forfeited. But not granted or denied.
Right. And then
what
later
hurdle came, would he have right. to overcome, if any, to establish entitlement for his dependents?
And do you know? I mean,
well, the statute that allows entitlement of benefits despite a forfeiture, you don't have to re-adjudicate the forfeiture. So the forfeiture is still there. It's just whether or not the dependents can take in his place. So I don't think you'd have
to... So what would be the process
right.
if his client got married and wanted to file and say, hey, look, I know I forfeit, but what about my family? What
right.
would be the, do you know what the process would be?
Well, at that point, they would see what he would be entitled to and if his dependents qualified for that. So
would not have to reopen the forfeiture procedure.
You would not have to reopen.
It would be treated as if it were an initial claim?
Exactly. Well, exactly. Because, again, even under forfeiture, it's not that he hasn't forfeited. Even if he was bringing this claim for the first time and he was saying, and by the way, if you I've got these dependents as well, and VA was adjudicating all at once, he would still forfeit. They would just see if his dependents could take benefits in his place.
Right. I'm just concerned about if they would be required to take an additional procedural hurdle.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It would be because you don't have to reopen a forfeiture because the forfeiture still stands.
I understand that, but if there was an underlying claim that was never processed, that's the part that I don't understand how you get to. They just walk in and say, decide my claim?
Okay, so you're saying because
Mr. Antolin's case, his entitlement to benefits initially was never adjudicated according to the record that we have.
Right.
If he had a wife or got married today or whatever and walked in tomorrow and said, I want benefits for this person, what would he need to do? He's, in theory, not reopening the forfeiture because he's not
correct.
Challenging whether he gets benefits. What he's asking is whether, how do I get her benefits?
Well, she would be like a new claim.
Okay.
But again, the law has changed. I don't think that was the law originally. It certainly wasn't the law.
We've gotten into the realm of hypotheticals, I understand.
Okay. And then addressing the new and material portion of this, this case, I'd like to draw the court's attention to the fact that the board correctly decided this. All the evidence that the appellant has cited to that came subsequent to the October 76 decision was before the agency decision makers in October 1976. Specifically, in his deposition in July 1974, appellant said, I consented to work as a BC because I could not do otherwise.
What page of the record are you looking at?
Yeah, it is page 79. And this is the July 1974 deposition of the appellant.
Okay, I have.
And it's about halfway down the page.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the question was, what was your reaction when you were told that you were being trained as a BC? I thought of withdrawing, but I could not do otherwise, so I consented to work as a BC. Another statement that he makes is, he was forced by necessity to take an oath of allegiance. It's just further down the page. And he feared that his parents would be killed. It's, I think, on the next
Let's
page.
Assume that he, in fact, did raise the defense of necessity. Okay, or the, I'm not sure you call it a defense in a claim situation, but the circumstance of necessity. Isn't there evidence presented after 1976 that gives more specificity and detail with regard to why he believed that he was compelled to join the constabulary?
Well, Your Honor, I think there was more detail, but I think all of the same argument was essentially before the October 76th decision maker.
Is argument the same as evidence?
No, sir. No, Your Honor. But
so are there new facts?
I don't believe so, because, you know, again, it was all before. He talked about his suffering in the prisoner of war camp and inhumane treatment and the condition he was in, that he was weak, that he was very thin.
Did he ever say that the reason that he joined the constabulary was in order to get medical treatment, because he, and that if he didn't get the medical treatment, he would have died? Is that, did he ever say that?
No, Your Honor, he didn't say that.
He said that after 1976, though, didn't he?
That's correct. Although, again, that evidence of the fact of his medical condition was before the agency.
Okay, I understand that. Now, let me ask you this. If somebody is denied service connection for some physical disability, let's say a knee problem, and he's denied service connection because the medical evidence is not sufficient, and then comes in with subsequent medical opinions that would indicate that the condition is worse than, let's say, initially, or was certainly links it to his service. Wouldn't that be new evidence that should be considered?
Yes, I mean, it would.
Can we clarify? We're talking about the old reg. Wasn't the old reg applicable here, not the new regulations for new and material definitions?
It's before the change in 2001.
So redundancy and duplication.
I'm only talking about newness.
I just want to make it clear, because there is a difference between the old and the new. Under the new regulations, I think it would be new. Under the old, I think redundancy and duplication fell under that. And I just, are you talking about the old reg or the one applicable here? Judge Hagel?
I'm talking about the reg that's applicable here.
Okay. Just so I understand, Your Honor, if I understand Your Honor's question. So in a service connection case, and he's saying it's worse now, would that be enough to reopen? And
I said, would that be new evidence?
Oh, I see. Yes, it would. It may not be material, but it would be new evidence.
Now, are you talking about the new reg or the old reg?
Well, again, I think it would depend on the detail of the. I'm talking about the current. The regulation word, the old one, is what we're dealing with today. But if it was not cumulative, obviously, then it would be new. But it would depend on the fact.
I'm getting at is, isn't the essence of if in fact this forfeiture proceeding was legitimate, and he did raise the defense of necessity, or the circumstance of necessity, did actually raise it, and the agency rejected it. Isn't the very purpose of the new and material evidence standard to permit somebody to come in and say, oh, okay, well, maybe I didn't give you enough information, and so I want you to take another look at it? That's the very purpose of them to do that. And there's a difference, isn't there, between evidence and argument?
Yes, sir.
So would you agree that new facts have come into play after 1976? In the sense that they weren't before the agency before?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because he described his medical condition before the agency decision makers in 74 and 72 and 71 in his applications. He described his medical condition. The only thing that he did different was by the way, one of the reasons I joined the BC was because of my medical condition. So,
well, that's a pretty big fact, isn't it? If you thought you were going to die if you didn't join the constabulary, isn't that pretty important?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be important, but again,
and may not, under all the circumstances, it may not get the veteran eventually. The forfeiture decision may end up being the same based upon the fact that the veteran changed his story and. He didn't reveal the information initially, but only after other information came to light and so forth. But we're talking about reopening and considering those things now.
Right. But what he's saying, the only new part of it, if you're going to make the assertion that it is new, would be that he's giving it as a reason. I mean, he's not saying he's not describing a condition that was a medical condition that was any different than what he had described previously. So in that sense, there's no new facts.
Let
me just ask this one other question. So the new fact is his expressed and more specific declaration of motivation. I mean, would you agree?
Right.
That is new.
Right, Your Honor. Although the Secretary believes that that's cumulative because all that, there certainly was an inference by all his statements of I could not do otherwise and this was the condition I was in and it was inhumane treatment and all this. There certainly was an inference that, this was desperate circumstances and that was considered by the agency decision makers in October 76.
I'm curious about a statement in the Secretary's brief that talks about that duress or necessity is not something that's available in this forfeiture determination. Could you expound upon why, since the Secretary didn't cite to anything to explain that?
Right. Yes, Your Honor. Basically, we're not dealing with a criminal context. This is a claim for VA benefits, and a criminal defense is part of, obviously, criminal law and regards that. So under the forfeiture statute that we're dealing with, the question is, did he render assistance to the enemy? And if he rendered assistance to the enemy, he's barred from benefits.
So the only defense available under the Secretary's construction is that he did not render assistance to the enemy?
Correct, Your Honor.
Not that there was a justification for rendering assistance to the
Correct,
enemy?
Correct, Your Honor.
And do you have any basis to support that?
Well, just the plain language of the statute. It is what is rendering assistance that, based on its face, the forfeiture statute indicates that if you're guilty of treason, mutiny, or rendering assistance to the enemy, you are barred, you forfeit your benefits.
Well, since he was not criminally adjudicated of having rendered assistance to the agency, he was not able to raise that defense in a criminal context, such as in the Fleming case. So he's being held to the same standard as a criminal defendant, but not being allowed to offer the same defenses, for better use of a better word, as a criminal defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the statute stands for.
What about Regulation 3.905B4?
3.905B4. Return to it.
Okay. So you can turn it in, but it doesn't matter?
The right to submit an evidence or evidence for 60 days.
To rebut the charges or to explain the person's position. And the statute itself talks about guilt, doesn't it?
It does. It does, Your Honor, yes. But again, yes, it does. Also, just to make the court aware that these things were considered in the 1959 committee reports when they were going to do a revision or looking for a revision of the statute, which at that time was 3504. And yet, in the end, they did not change. They looked at the concern for.
Let me go back to the regulation then. What does
okay.
it mean?
You mean
3.905B4. You can submit evidence to rebut the charges or explain the person's position.
Okay.
And
well,
would not duress? I mean, despite that, duress doesn't matter?
Well, because he's still aiding the enemy, rendering assistance to the enemy. The statute 6104 doesn't allow for there's no defenses implied in that. There's no excuses.
You don't have a reg that says that, though.
No, just the plain
just
reading.
A statement in the brief, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The Secretary finds this rendering assistance to the enemy action beyond a reasonable doubt, correct?
I don't know where they've cited a standard as far as that.
Well, I believe it's stated in the decision itself.
In the forfeiture decision. Okay.
And some of the legislative history discusses it.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, you're correct. Page 96 of the record.
Does that have any impact on what kind of evidence somebody would need to submit to reopen a forfeiture determination? Is there a higher burden, a lower burden, same burden, doesn't matter?
I think it's the same burden that's implied in the regulation on new material evidence.
Can I go back to new material? As I understand it, the board decision upon review considered the statement of the appellant that he felt, and I don't have it right in front of me, but basically coerced and under duress, that he would be killed if he didn't proceed to aid the enemy, work with the enemy. That the board's review of that was that it was cumulative.
Correct.
And under the old regulation, if it's cumulative, it is not new.
Correct.
But under the new regulation, it would be new, and then the issue would be whether or not it was material.
Correct.
So given that and applying the old regulation, I thought I heard you say that the secretary took the position that the board was correct, that it was cumulative, and therefore it was not new under the old regulation. Is that correct? Is that your position?
Our position is that it's cumulative under the old
And therefore regulation. Not new.
Therefore not new.
Thank you.
If we were to find that this is new evidence, do you believe it's material? What's the Secretary's position?
It's not material, Your Honor. It's not so significant that it must be considered in order to decide the claim or bears directly substantially on the specific matter because it's, again, the agency decision makers understood the conditions he was in at the time, but that was all before the agency decision makers.
Well, wait a minute. If we find it's new, okay, then we would find that it wasn't before the agency
okay.
at the time. So my question is, if we were to find it was new, would you believe that this evidence is material? What's the Secretary's position on materiality?
It would not be material, Your Honor, because, again, under the statute, he rendered assistance to the enemy.
Even given the regulation that Judge Castle just quoted, which gives the individual permission to submit such evidence?
Well, he can certainly submit evidence.
But if he can submit it, but the Secretary doesn't have to consider it?
Well, there could be other evidence he could submit. He could say that there could be evidence that he didn't really, in fact, render assistance to the enemy.
So are you going back more to the Colvin standard, that it's not an outcome determinative addition to the record?
That it's not outcome, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand.
Well, I thought you were saying, because what he's submitting is that he, it's a reason that he rendered assistance to the enemy, and the VA is not willing to accept a reason for that, so therefore it couldn't change the outcome, so it can't be material. Or is there some other basis for the Secretary to determine that it's not material?
Well, in order for it to be material, it needs to bear directly and substantially upon the specific matter under consideration. And
it needs to be so significant that it must be considered in order to fairly decide the merits of the claim.
Right, and I would argue that's not so significant.
Because it's not an acceptable defense to the Secretary?
Because there are no defenses to the rendering assistance to the enemy.
Okay. I'm sorry, Judge Hagel, I cut you off.
Oh, that's all right.
Let us assume that we did reach the decision that it was new. Could the court go on to reach a determination about materiality?
If the court determined that it was new, certainly the court could make a decision on whether or not it was material.
The Secretary and the board decision, did they get to materiality on this particular element?
Not on the issue that was briefed by the by appellate counsel.
So would that affect the court's ability to make that, let's say, factual determination, or is that something we have the authority to go on and do? Or would it be more properly remanded to the secretary?
It would be more properly remanded.
What's the standard of review we should be reviewing this under?
As far as new and material, the general standard is clearly erroneous, and that would be the standard that you would apply.
So your position is these are findings of fact, and if we don't believe that we, in order to overturn that finding, in other words, to say that this, to overturn and finding that this evidence is not new, we would have to find that the board's decision is clearly erroneous.
Correct, Your Honor. The de novo review only applies if you're interpreting the regulation with statute.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
In closing, if I may just...
Yes, you may. I'm sorry.
A few points. Again, Your Honors, what was before the record in October 1976 is that the appellant worked for the Bureau of Constabulary, that he... during the period of time that the United States was at war with Japan, he wore the uniform, he wore the insignia of the BC, he carried arms and ammunition, and he participated in patrols against guerrillas. The board decision correctly found that the evidence that presented was not new, and that this was cumulative of what was before the agency decision makers before. Therefore, since the board correctly followed the regulation case law, it should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could start with Judge Sholin's question about the board's determination. At page 20 of the record, the concluding paragraph at the bottom of the page says, for the reasons noted above, the board concludes that the evidence received since the October 1976 decision determining that VA benefits were subject to forfeiture under 3504, now 6104, is not new and material.
Yes, but if I could direct counsel to page 16 of the record.
I understand that there's a contradictory
yes.
finding. I'm simply pointing out the contradiction. And
we can all agree there was no discussion of materiality of that particular argument.
I believe we can.
Okay.
But it the findings of fact that were made are at page 3.
Yes.
Those seem equally ambiguous and nonspecific, at least in terms of understanding what the board was doing. However, it seems to me that their final conclusion attempted to encompass both. Now I'd like to turn to the argument made by the government about the amendment by Congress of Section 211A to overrule the two federal D.C. Circuit decisions. Number one, any overruling pertained only to the question of the right of the federal judiciary to exercise jurisdiction over a decision by the secretary. And it is not, therefore, an overruling of the judicial determination made in interpreting the language of what was then 3504, and I believe even before that 706, if I'm remembering the right statute number. It also then raises the question as to whether or not this court is or is not bound by that, whether the court is or isn't bound by that interpretation or not. I do not believe that this court's case law has as yet interpreted the meaning of 6104A in terms of rendering assistance to the enemy, and specifically with the rather broad sweeping position that has been articulated by the government that there are simply no defenses to rendering assistance to the enemy. This statutory scheme has imposed or given discretion to the secretary to make a determination, and the determination made was beyond a reasonable doubt And we're clearly dealing with a person who may or may not have been subject to any right to judicial review. Clearly, by the amendment in 1970, he was probably prohibited from that amendment. So the first time that he gets an opportunity for judicial review and the benefit of counsel is when he takes advantage of the amendment to the statute in 1988, which then does expressly overrule the notion of the bar to judicial review of decisions of the secretary. So ultimately, as I begin, this court, I believe, needs to make an interpretation of 6104A.
Okay, let's presume that we do ascertain that necessity is an available response to the secretary's finding. How do you deal with the fact that your client, and Mr. Antolon, remained in rendering assistance to the enemy for 13 months, opposed to seeking an earlier opportunity to stop rendering assistance to the enemy?
Well, I believe that goes to ultimately the definition or interpretation of rendering assistance to the enemy. Your question presupposes that mere participation in the BC was sufficient. I direct the court's attention to the concurring opinion by former Chief Judge Nebaker in Macaruto, no doubt I'm butchering the pronunciation, v. Gober at 10 Vet App 388. At page 390, and in his concurring opinion, Judge Nebaker noted that an absence of coercion was pertinent to the findings of membership in the BC in order to be sufficient to deny benefits. Now, clearly, that's dicta. It's a concurrence. It is not part of the majority's opinion, but I believe it is entirely consistent with the D.C. Circuit opinions interpreting 6104A, and I believe that the assertion that mere participation in the BC is sufficient to, quote, render assistance is simply not adequate to support a forfeiture, even if it was lawful to forfeit.
But isn't that a different argument than necessity? Because what you're arguing is that mere participation is not assistance, as opposed to, yes, I assisted, but this is why.
And that's why I suggest that it is incumbent upon this court to interpret 6104A for both propositions.
Okay, well, let us suppose that we have reached the determination in Mr. Antolon's case, for the sake of argument, that he had rendered assistance to the enemy, if that was a determination for us to make.
Mm-hmm.
Then how would you deal with the fact that he continued to render assistance for 13 months?
Well, and I apologize, I do not mean to quibble, but I'm not sure that it would be appropriate to go that far, even in a hypothetical. I think based upon the interpretation, it would be more appropriate to send it back to the board for that fact-finding. But presupposing that the board made such fact-finding, I will answer your question. I believe it is critical that this court determine that this defense is available. It's consistent with the VA's regulation about submitting evidence relevant to an allegation of a crime. Clearly, what is being alleged here would be a crime. The burden of proof relied upon by the forfeiture decision was beyond a reasonable doubt. I think trying for the VA to pretend that this wasn't prosecuted as a crime and that this wasn't an adversarial proceeding is simply to deny the reality of what took place.
But answering my question about the 13 months...
That would have to be a factual question to be determined by the trier of fact, by the board, as to whether or not, under the defense of necessity or duress, that his going into that under those circumstances would have provided a legitimate basis to avoid the liability under the statute for forfeiture. Because it seems to me that that's what the duress is about, to give a somewhat more contemporary analogy to the Patty Hearst circumstance. Once kidnapped, did she become liable for the actions taken thereafter?
But if you're currently arguing only that his mens rea evidence that is new and is relevant and is material is about his medical condition and how he needed critical medical care, and that was why he joined the BC, that doesn't have an ongoing component. So I'm just troubled by the applicability of the necessity defense in this instance.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure why it would not have an ongoing component. The reality of his circumstances was he spent nearly a year as a prisoner of war. Once he worked for the constabulary, his health was restored. His only option was to go back to the prisoner of war camp. That duress was still hanging over his head. His circumstances could easily have been reversed, or he could have been killed outright for refusing to continue to participate.
Why couldn't he just run away and escape?
Well, to me, that's what the defense of duress is about, and not about getting into the questions of what he might have done, but simply whether or not the legal defense of duress or necessity was appropriate to be considered as an exception or an excuse for a defense to the forfeiture of his rights to benefits. There isn't any question that he served. There's any question that he was a prisoner of war. What potentially prevents him from receiving benefits that he was never awarded, was his action with the constabulary. And it is the initiation of that action and the circumstances of that action that certainly rise to the minimal level of new and material evidence in order to be able to have the merits re-decided in the first instance.
If we presume that necessity is available, is there any evidence in the record prior to the current litigation of necessity in the record?
You're out of time, but go ahead and answer.
In the 1976 decision,
was there any evidence of necessity in the record at that time?
Other than those statements made by Mr. Untalan that were described by the government, I do not believe that there was anything, and I'm not sure that would have necessarily arisen to that, but those were the only things that I could locate in the record.
And you challenge whether they actually even speak to necessity.
Correct.
And is there any significance to the fact that the forfeiture decision references reasons for him joining the BC but doesn't address those articulated by the Secretary as pointing to his necessity defense?
Yes.
The
very fact that they're differing grounds, and that the forfeiture proceeding was on one basis and the board decided it essentially on a different basis.
So do you believe that the, I believe it was the CMP administrator, did not consider the defense of necessity in 1976?
I see no reason to believe that he had. That it was either asserted or that he had.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel.
What's more of a breach? Remember what you said about judges surprising the comments?
Yeah, I plead guilty this time.
This case will be submitted to the notes.